It is Monday, February 15th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll hear from our correspondent in California, where President Obama is preparing for an unusual summit with the leaders of 10 Southeast Asian nations. Another VOA correspondent on the Turkish-Syrian border tells us what happened when several hospitals on the Syrian side came under attack on Monday, and
cancer don't discriminate, or care if you're just 38.
We'll tell you how the U.S. country music industry is coming together to help cancer victims. It's all ahead on International Edition. President Obama welcomes the leaders of 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to the California resort of Sunnylands on Monday. The two-day summit of U.S. and ASEAN leaders is the first of its kind to be hosted by the United States. ASEAN comprises the nations of Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, Brunei, Vietnam, Laos, Myanmar, and Cambodia. Our White House correspondent Mariela Salinas is with the president in Sunnylands, and I asked her earlier what kind of relationship the U.S. has with the various ASEAN countries.
Yeah, it's very interesting because they're all so different, and this White House acknowledges that. Officials say they're at various stages of democracy. They have various political models. They're so different in terms of the religion, ethnic differences. And one other reason why they want to develop one centralized organization, Obama sees ASEAN as that good forum to sort of build this framework to bring all these countries together despite their differences. Now, in human rights, democracy, White House officials say we know there are different levels. We're not going to dictate to them what that should be, but certainly where we see some movement toward democracy, we will support those countries.
What about those ASEAN nations? Why is it important for their leaders to all be coming to the United States for this event?
Well, they have all accepted the invitation. I think it shows how important they see it to their own countries. Remember, they all have their own issues at home. There are some people at home who support this. There are some people at home who don't support this. But I think everybody realizes that this kind of a structure is required for all of them to continue to prosper. And the growth is just astonishing. I mean, it is moving so quickly. And one thing that, you know, is surfacing is that oftentimes U.S. businesses consider it sort of low-cost operations there, but that's not the way it's evolving. There are a lot of innovation. There's a lot of technology. There's a lot of sort of knowledge-based models that are emerging there. And the U.S. is saying, hey, we're really good at that. We can help, and you can help us.
Well, China is not part of ASEAN, but it's also expected to feature highly in those discussions between Obama and the ASEAN leaders. Why is that?
Well, China is a superpower in their backyard, and everyone wants to see a good relationship between the United States and China. They both want to operate there, and these ASEAN countries want to see relations good. It makes them very uneasy when tensions arise, which they have, with regard to the South China Sea and maritime operations there. And so it's a very delicate balance the U.S. has to walk. But the U.S. maintains that it's able to work with China, even though they disagree that they have a very sort of broad and complex relationship. They're able to move forward on issues where they agree and to come to the table and discuss the areas in which they don't agree. And right now there are a lot of areas, including North Korea, and how much pressure China should put on Pyongyang to stop any provocative acts related to its nuclear program. And so they will have to work together.
What other issues are on ASEAN's agenda for this summit?
Well, I mean, I think a big one is trade and commerce. I think there's going to be a lot of their businesses here from the U.S. They also really want to push people-to-people contacts. And the U.S. sees that as being very important because It opens up civil societies in the ASEAN nations, and it is an important way to solidify relations between the two when you have that people-to-people contact and sort of understanding the various cultures. So that is another big part that we don't discuss a lot. It's, you know, as much as we do some of the trade and commerce and security issues, but those are going to be important parts of this as well.
Well, thank you very much to our White House correspondent in California, Mariela Salinas, for that update.
My pleasure, Michael.
Well, let's take a look at the online buzz surrounding the ASEAN summit with the United States. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, joins me in the studio to bring us the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what are some of the Twitter accounts that we should be following during this summit?
The official ASEAN account at ASEAN is a good one, but I also want to recommend the U.S. Mission to ASEAN. The Jakarta-based account can be found at U.S. Mission, 2 in Arabic number, ASEAN.
Okay, well, what kinds of tweets are the official U.S. accounts putting out about this summit?
Oh, of course, many U.S. government accounts are tweeting about the summit and using the hashtag US-ASEAN2016. The State Department tweeted, U.S. is taking its relationship with ASEAN to a new level. Learn more about our strategic partnership. So you can definitely tell Washington's quote-unquote pivot to Asia is real.
Well, what about ASEAN dignitaries? Have they been saying anything about this summit online?
Yeah, some are, especially those from former English-speaking colonies like yourself. So here I have tweets from Malaysia and the Philippines. The former was a British colony and the latter American. As you know, Michael, Anwar Ibrahim is a controversial figure in Malaysia. The former deputy PM sent out this tweet. President Obama will host the leaders of the 10-country Association of Southeast Asian Nations, so no frills, just facts. He's actually serving a 5-year prison term, so I am not sure how he's tweeting, but his handle is at Anwar Ibrahim. Another tweet is from the Filipino President Noynoy Aquino at Noynoy Aquino. Most of his tweets are in Tagalog, but there are a couple in English from today. One of them reads like this. President Aquino arrived at 9:01 a.m. in Palm Springs International Airport with a photo of the president attached. We would love to hear from our listeners what they're expecting from the summit. So, Michael, please do the honors and share our Twitter handle.
I'll do that. But just before we do that, you mentioned I'm from an English-speaking colony. That is Hong Kong, of course. Well, you can tweet us at VOA_IE. We'd love to hear what you're expecting from the summit. And you can follow G on Twitter. She is at G Abby Lee. And I'm there, too, at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Wild Skyrian horses once numbered in the thousands on the small Greek island of Skyros. But these small, sturdy horses are now under threat of extinction, with about 280 pure Skyrians left. Make that 281. Amanda Simpson Katsarilias of the Skyros Island Horse Trust just welcomed a new foal into the world.
She has the right height, the right conformation, the right coloring. Alongside of that, you're also looking for a pony that could survive on the mountain.
Katsarilias, along with her partner, co-founded the Skyros Island Horse Trust to try to preserve the breed, and they now have 48 of the horses in their care. Skyrians differ from other Greek horses as they are especially small, measuring not more than 116 centimeters tall. The horse's presence on the island is said to date back to the Trojan War, but habitat loss and interbreeding with domestic horses caused the numbers to drop dramatically. Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. The United Nations says missile attacks on medical facilities and schools in northern Syria killed almost 50 civilians on Monday, among them children. The facilities that were hit included a 30-bed hospital run by the international aid group Doctors Without Borders. Earlier Monday, our correspondent Jamie Detmer was just across the border in the Turkish town of Kilis, where some of those who were wounded were brought from Syria. My colleague Susan Yaki spoke to him and asked Detmer what happened in Monday's attacks.
In fact, it's not just one hospital that was hit today. There were four, two in Idlib province, two in Aleppo province. One hospital was a pediatric hospital just over the border from Kilis Abizaz, which had been struck before. And some of the injured from that hospital were being brought over, as well as the injured from a school that had been sheltering displaced Syrians elsewhere in northern Aleppo countryside as well. And we're not too sure about the numbers of dead in that one, because a lot of people are buried in rubble and there's no one really available to be able to dig them out. Outside the hospital at Kilis, there were a lot of crowds. Syrian refugees were already here. Some were relatives of the wounded who were being brought across. We counted 36 going into the hospital. We know that three of those died. And outside the hospital, there's a lot of anger amongst particularly the relatives and other Syrian refugees who feel that we have had these strikes a few days after there's talk of a cessation of hostilities, but the airstrikes by the regime, people believe these airstrikes were carried out by the regime, just continue and the deaths mount up.
What did they tell you personally?
One man, Mustafa, I talked to, who had been wounded on the right side of his torso and his shoulder. There was blood seeping through his bandages when he talked to me. Two of his sisters were being operated on. They'd been wounded in a strike near the school in northern Aleppo countryside, the school housing. And they'd heard an explosion, the impact of a missile outside their home. The family, nine of them, had gone out to inspect, which had been, as he said later on, a mistake, because then they were hit by another explosion. One of the family members, a 45-year-old, he says, was killed, and then the rest of the family were all wounded.
Is there a feeling that there's just no place to run and hide?
Yes, I think that's precisely what's happening. To try to escape, to try to flee, to try to find safety. And wherever they turn, there's conflict. You have so many groups now fighting. You've got the regime airstrikes. Of course, you've got coalition airstrikes in the IS territory areas as well. You've got the YPG, the Kurds, fighting against the rebels. You've got the rebels fighting against the regime, the rebels fighting against the Islamic State. So it's very, very difficult for these displaced people to try to become refugees and leave Syria and get into Turkey, because they're trying to dodge these airstrikes, they're trying to dodge these micro-conflicts they're going through, and a landscape that they describe more like a Mad Max movie. And even when they make the border to try to get across, they've still got the risk of being shot by Turkish border guards as they try to enter illegally, because, as you know, most of the border is now closed by Turks. It has been for a year. They're letting very few refugees in. We know that there are at least 30,000 right by the border gate near Kilis, but the numbers are higher.
And that was VOA's Jamie Detmer at the Turkish town of Kilis near the Syrian border, speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Thousands of Mexicans gathered in a sports field in the impoverished southern state of Chiapas on Monday for an open-air mass that Pope Francis conducted in three indigenous languages. Pope Francis asked Mexico's indigenous population for forgiveness for the exclusion they have suffered in society. Mexico expert Barry Carr of Australia's La Trobe University told VOA's Victor Beatty that the Pope's relatively lengthy visit to Mexico represents a conscious decision to visit remote areas such as Chiapas.
It is a very largely indigenous state, so a very high proportion of the population are made up of people of the Mayan family group of language speakers, and it's a state that's been extremely poor over the years, with a history of a lot of violence directed against the indigenous population. And since the early 1990s, it's also been a state that's been convulsed in conflict between the Zapatista forces, group of indigenous and in some cases Spanish-speaking peasants and their supporters, and the federal government. So it's a very interesting choice to go to this conflict zone.
What do you think his purpose will be there? It's called the least Catholic of any area in Mexico.
Clearly, in Mexico, as in many other parts of Latin America, Catholicism is facing quite a bit of competition. The days when the Catholic Church more or less enjoyed a monopoly over Christian expression have long since passed, as evangelical Protestant groupings of all kinds have risen in importance. And southern Mexico and parts of Central America are certainly areas where the evangelicals now are providing quite a bit of competition. So that's one, I think, way of looking at the Pope's visit. He's trying to reassert the voice of Catholicism, but also he's trying to do so in a way that recognizes the mistakes committed by the Church over many hundreds of years in their treatment of indigenous people.
In Ecatepec, a Mexico City suburb, on Sunday, the Pope held an open-air mass attended by some 300,000, and he took on the twin themes of the plight of migrants and also the drug violence that seems to be plaguing that entire country.
Pope Francis, who of course is a Latin American, and we mustn't forget that. I mean, he's the first Latin American pope. He doesn't have to speak Spanish with an accent or through a translator. He's certainly a pope who has a reputation for being bold in his political and social statements on behalf of the urban and rural poor. And Ecatepec is an industrial area with a large population of relatively poor working class Mexicans. It's clear that he's not shying away from the really sensitive topics of the day, namely the war on drugs and the terrible violence that's been associated with that. And about 100,000 people have been killed in Mexico, and about 25 to 30,000 people have disappeared since 2005, 2006.
And you've been listening to Mexico analyst Barry Carr of Australia's La Trobe University in conversation with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Russia's economic crisis is pushing millions of people into poverty as the cost of living mounts and real wages shrink. In the Russian capital, charity and social workers are now helping those most in need. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow.
A small Salvation Army soup kitchen in Moscow fills with hungry people. More than 20 million Russians are living below the poverty line since last year, as the economy shrank and prices for clothing and food went up. But authorities in Moscow say alcoholism, not poverty, is the main reason Russians here are homeless.
The people with the lowest incomes get social payouts from the state up to the minimum subsistence rate. That is why any Russian citizen is safeguarded from homelessness, and the low level of income cannot be a reason for losing their residence.
But many are also migrant laborers, unable to find work.
They came here because there was no work at home. Others do not want to return because their families expect money. They are ashamed to come home empty-handed.
As companies cut jobs and working hours, more Russians are at risk. With fewer contracts available and a worsening leg injury, electrical engineer Vladimir Zakharov is seeking help.
There was no work, which means nothing to pay the rent. I got some advice to go to the center. They said the center could help me out for a little while.
Moscow authorities started sending out a social patrol van in 2009 to seek out the homeless and offer help. Since then, the fleet has grown to 30 vehicles, providing medical care and essentials to those most in need. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Well, philanthropy has always been an integral part of U.S. country music. One country music star, Martina McBride, recently announced a new venture to raise awareness about cancer. VOA's Nikki Strong joined International Edition's Sarah Williams to discuss the details.
Nikki, tell us about this new initiative called Band Against Cancer.
Okay, so Band Against Cancer is a partnership with some heavy hitters, with Sarah Cannon, the Global Cancer Institute of Hospital Corporation of America, and the record label Big Label Machine Group, which has an incredible roster of artists, including Taylor Swift, Reba McEntire, Florida Georgia Line, Tim McGraw, Martina McBride, to name a few. So Martina McBride, along with several other high-profile country artists, no word yet as to who it will be, they will hit the road for the Sarah Cannon Tour. Details are still forthcoming, but right now we do know the tour will hit several cities across the U.S. and end in October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Now, not only will these concerts help raise money for charitable organizations, cancer support organizations, but each concert is going to have special on-site activities so that attendees can also find ways to be a more active part of the Band Against Cancer movement, aside from just, you know, paying to go see a concert. And the objective, they say, is to bring together survivors and patients and families and friends and artists and music lovers and cancer experts and advocates in communities across the country in this fight against cancer. And through these various collective efforts, patients will ultimately access high quality treatment and research options that are close to home where they are.
Mm. Well, will this initiative cover all kinds of cancer?
Well, the initiative initially we'll focus on those who'll be fighting blood cancer, and then eventually we'll highlight other kinds of cancer as well.
Now, Martina had a huge song that was about fighting cancer.
Yes, yes, which is so appropriate why she's headlining this. The song is called I'm Gonna Love You Through It. It came out in 2011 off of her CD 11, and it's about a 38-year-old woman who is supported by her husband while battling breast cancer. It was nominated for a Grammy that year. It peaked at number 4 on the country singles chart, and it has really been a major anthem in the cancer-fighting community. And Martina has participated in all kinds of events to raise awareness about this disease. So, and she says helping families who are facing cancer has always been a cause that is near and dear to her heart.
You can get more information about this initiative at bandagainstcancer.org. You can also hear Martina McBride and other great country artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you're on social media, feel free to connect with Nikki at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA underscore music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
She dropped the phone and burst into tears.
And that brings us to the end of International Edition on the Voice of America. Today's show is brought to you by director Tracy Carter, engineer Zaina Abdulrahman, and myself, Michael Lippin, in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. Have a great week.
With three kids who need you in their
lives. Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.